Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Steve Wheeler in this episode. Steve is an early pioneer in distance and e-learning with multiple publications, keynotes, blog posts, and books linking educational theory and practice. His scholarly and pragmatic views about teaching and learning provide accessible insight into effective practice. I'm talking with Steve Wheeler, a learning innovations consultant and former associate professor of learning technologies at Plymouth University. Steve is an active blogger and international speaker and is a senior fellow of the European Distance Education Network. Steve, it's really good to be talking with you.
Good to speak to you as well, Mark.
Thanks, Steve. Can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
I started off in what was then known as educational technology. I suppose it is to some people, but it was a new and emerging field way back in 1976. So that when you can work out how old I am probably from that, because I was quite young at the time when I started. I'd just left college and got into educational technology at very, very early stages of it. And in 76, everything was very teacher-centered. One of the things I've noticed over the years as ed tech or learning technologies evolved has been the fact that it's become a lot more learner-centered, and increasingly so as personal devices have come into place. And through the years, I've worked in various media and learning technology environments, mainly in the 80s and 90s in the National Health Service, where I was training nurses and paramedics and midwives and people like that. And then around about 1996, I got involved in a project, which was a rural areas training project, as they called it in them days. And it was one of the first tele-learning projects that Europe had seen. In fact, I think it was the largest at the time. With my team, we set up 43 distance education or distance learning centers in rural areas, hard to get areas. Yeah. And my job was to, as the training manager, was to deliver, to broker all the training and then deliver it into those centers. And when I left, we had something like 3,500 learners. And I left in 98 to join what was then the Faculty of Education as a senior lecturer in distance education. And basically, that's where I was until 3 years ago when I took early retirement. I'm still a visiting research fellow at Plymouth University, where I still look after one remaining PhD student of mine, which was part of the deal when I left. I said I would remain until they all came to completion. And then also I'm a tutor now, a part-time tutor working on the master's program at Marjon Plymouth University, which is for serving teachers, mainly head teachers and senior staff. That's where I am at the moment with my career. So I've done lots of projects in between that. And it's been a slow evolution of technology from my perspective over 44 years now. I guess my publications during that time from the 90s onwards, I guess, reflect my interest in psychology and how that impacts upon our understanding of people's use of learning technologies and personal technologies. And over the years, around about 100 and 150 publications, mainly journal articles and international conference papers and so on, but also 6 books in this area as well, my most recent being last year for Kogan Page, where I published a book called Digital Learning in Organizations, which was more, I suppose, faced towards learning and development than it was universities, but still, nevertheless, all about learning and technology.
Fantastic. So across 44 years of research and publications, obviously you've been talking about a great deal across that time. What are some of the themes that you think have endured across that time period?
I think that teachers' reluctance to allow students to take over and to lead has been persistent. That's not a very good thing for me. I think that, you know, I spent most of my life trying to convince colleagues to let students take more lead in these areas, but most teachers still seem convinced that they've got to lead, that they've got to be at the front, that they've got to be in control all the time. I mean, there are times when you need to maintain some kind of structure and control, but generally speaking, I think that teachers are very reluctant to let go of that control, and that for me is one of the most persistent things. So I guess I'm more interested, Mark, in pedagogy than I am in technology. I always have been. I've always been involved in thinking about people and their behavior and their perceptions. So for me, that's probably the thing that's been most persistent and hasn't really changed. And another thing that hasn't really changed for many places, although I know there's some innovation going on around the world, is the kind of the design of classrooms, the design of that confined space, those four walls in which learning is supposed to be taking place. Clearly, that's a nonsense because learning takes place everywhere, but the formalized learning in the classroom seems to be still stuck in a rut where we still build forward-seated chairs and we have no place for students to plug in their laptops and recharge their batteries on their smartphones when they need to. And there's still a big element of this is the front. Let's face the front now, because this is where the teacher is. This is where all the action's taking place. I did a lot of disruption while I was at the University of Plymouth and also at Marjons as well, where what we're doing there is changing that very, very much. And there is no front anymore for me. There hasn't been for 20 years. Students take a much bigger lead in what's going on. And the pedagogy is much more focused on them than it is on us as teachers.
Great. Can you talk a bit about the practicalities of that? So what would that look like, walking into a classroom that's configured in the way that you've just talked about?
Well, I mean, for a start, you make sure that there are more power sockets available in the center of the room rather than on the sides where all the training leads create health hazards. And secondly, you make sure there's lots of open space and free space. I remember going into a lecture once and all the students were sat there, about 180 of them, all sat there waiting for me to consolidate a whole module, which had been taught by about seven or eight of my colleagues and myself, 180 students in seminar groups. And they were in this final lecture, all sat there I was going to say in tears, but they were in tears, but not the crying kind. They were in kind of rows that kind of raked upwards to the ceiling, and I was down at the bottom. Yeah. And it was like being in a Roman amphitheater. And I thought, this is ridiculous. So I brought in a whole load of paper and pens, and I said, okay, get into groups of three and find some space somewhere in the room. And so, you know, every little group split off into three groups. I said, no, one of you come down, pick up a piece of A1 paper and a pen and get back up to your groups. And I said, okay, the first thing I want you to do is to draw a map, if you like, of everything you've learnt in this module. You know, all the different names of all the different things, all the different components of that module. So they draw these names, you know, they brainstormed and they were putting down things like special educational needs, behavior management and bullying and all the stuff that they'd learned in that module. I said, okay, now draw circles around each of them and join them together. So they did that. And I said, okay, and the next thing, and I was flying off the seat in my pants. I hadn't really worked it out. It was kind of doorknob pedagogy. You know, you walk in through the door and then you know, that's what I'm going to do. And so next thing I want you to do is to name those connections. And that was harder, obviously, and they had to struggle over that. And they started to argue and they started to really work hard then. And this was 20 minutes in there and they were still struggling to name the connections. Eventually they named the connections. I said, okay, now compare your notes with the person in the group next to you. So that there were now six people in groups together and then there were 12 and so on. And eventually I said to them, okay, now what you've got there is rather interesting because you've all got different interpretations. You've seen everyone else's work. You've seen your own. Take a picture of it, stick it onto Twitter. And then with this hashtag, and then I amalgamated them all together using a piece of software, and they saw all of their work on the screen in one place. I said, now go there and read that. There's your consolidation work. And that took the hour. And they said, well, that was amazing. We've learned so much. We never knew that we'd learned that much. And that was almost like a metacognition, a meta-learning process. But the thing was, it swapped it from being me at the front trying to help them to remember things to them showing what they'd remembered to each other. And that, for me, is the essence of the new approach to, you know, to student-centeredness. It was a very simple idea. It involved no technology whatsoever apart from the Twitter at the end and the software that amalgamated all of the images into one place, but it was the students showing and doing their own work and showing for themselves what they knew within their small groups. That, for me, is what it would look like.
Great. And, of course, you've got a distance background as well. So how would you take that same approach and translate it into a distance framework where students wouldn't necessarily be sitting together with an A1 sheet of paper? What are some of the techniques that you've seen that work really well under those conditions?
Well, I do that now. I do that with my master's groups. I have small master's groups who are all working towards an MA in education in research. And obviously, I'm not meeting with them because of the COVID restrictions, but they've closed the centre down now anyway. And I would have had to have travelled 60 miles down to the centre to teach every weekend and every evening. And what we do instead is we have a virtual group using either Teams or Zoom or another platform. It's usually Teams, actually, on the Microsoft platform.
Yeah.
And within that, there are various tools that you can use to help students to collaborate together. And they're going to go off on their own anyway. I mean, they told me this week, my group, I was teaching them on Tuesday night, and they told me, they said, oh, we've already met together once while you were sick. I thought, oh, wow, okay, because some of my meetings were cancelled. So they'd taken the initiative and met together on their own. I mean, they're adults. They're mature adults and they're senior staff, a lot of them, in schools. And they take the initiative. The onus is on them anyway. So they've been meeting in little side groups to consolidate their learning and to discuss and to collaborate and to share ideas and to ask questions of each other and so on.
Yeah.
So it happens almost naturally online.
Great. So by the sound of things, when the world turned to emergency remote teaching, you were able to take your existing collaborative practice and just continue that.
Yeah, I take issue with the word emergency teaching. I don't take issue with it because that's what it is for most people. But for me, having been a distance educator for nearly 30 years now, and being involved with technology for a lot longer, I think I had an advantage of already having those methods and techniques in my armory. Because I've been constantly practicing that anyway, but in a non-emergency situation. We've been doing it because of the quality of it rather than because of the necessity of it. And I think that needs to be a message that's writ large across the whole educational community. It's like, don't do this because you have to. Do it because you need to or because you want to. Because there are certain elements of distance education that you won't get in a face-to-face environment. Yeah, face-to-face environments are very rich, but they can go so wrong if certain things happen, disruptive behavior or disruption in trying to get to a place. Whereas when you're online, if you've got a good broadband connection and you've got access to the right technology, which most people have that I teach these days, then you can set up instantly tutorials, seminars, workshops, research groups, blog, shared blog groups, shared wiki pages. There's a whole range of things you can do which you couldn't do readily in a face-to-face classroom.
So, Steve, you've been a persistent blogger as well. If someone was to go to your blog, what are some of the key posts or key ideas that you'd suggest that they pick up on straight away?
It's interesting, this blogging lark, because I started probably about 2007, 2006, when it was quite new. And that blog is approaching 10 million views now, which I never thought it would do because it was just a little online diary for me. And I thought, well, I might as well share my thoughts because, people might come back and offer me stuff that I haven't thought of myself. Yeah. And so it was originally set up as a kind of just a little online diary for me, but it became a lot more than that. And it became, I suppose, one of the centers for me of my ideas and my research. And I share on there a whole range of things, not just formalized articles with references and so on, and a lot of research in them, but also just snap ideas and flash ideas of maybe one paragraph or two paragraphs of ideas, to float questions or even stir up a bit of controversy to get people going. Several years ago, myself and an American colleague, we had a bit of an exchange about academic writing about learning, and she sent me an image and said, write about this. And so I wrote about it, using the image as a prompt, as a writing prompt, and sent it back to her with a challenge. And I called it Blimage because it's a blog image. And the hashtag Blimage suddenly took off and became a global phenomenon. It went viral for about 3 or 4 weeks. Yeah. And something like about 500 or 600 people joined in every field of education, primary, secondary, tertiary, learning and development, even the military. People from many countries joined in. There was a huge hotbed of it in the Netherlands. People in New Zealand, where you are now, joined in. And it was a phenomenal experience because I gathered together a lot of those Blimage posts under that hashtag. And that is on the website. If you search for Blimage on steve-wheeler.co.uk, which is the website address, then you'll find literally a treasure trove of people's ideas, you know, just short articles around an image that they'd seen and what it meant to them personally in terms of their learning and their professional teaching. There are other things on there, reviews of technology. There are reviews of new pedagogical ideas. There are reviews on new and emerging theories. There are debates all around the idea of disruptive education through technology. So that's what you'll find on there. You'll find social commentary from me as well. You'll find that I analyze people like, I don't know, people like Pierre Bourdieu's work and Leven Wenger's concept of communities of practice and things like distributed cognition. These are all things that I write about. They're quite deep subjects, actually, but I try and make them accessible to anybody who wants to read it, and that includes informed lay people. So that's the kind of style of the blog, and there's also some humor in there because I never get away without lacing with a bit of humor when I feel the urge arise to do so. So it's quite an informal blog, but it's got a lot of depth to it, I think.
Yeah, I think that the giveaway's in the title, isn't it? Learning with ease, E as in e-learning.
Yeah, it's a lot of puns in there. Yeah,
brilliant. Steve, we're now 2020, coming towards the end of what's been a really strange year. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time? And of course, we are partly through COVID now as well. And I think in the UK, there's lockdown as we speak, isn't there?
Yep.
So what thoughts can you share with us about that?
Well, 2020 has been a tragic year, really. A lot of people have lost lives. Many more have lost their livelihoods. And I think the big opportunity from here is that it's forced educators everywhere to try to understand more the idea of technology and how it can be used to not just connect people, but also to support people's learning. That, to me, is one of the good things that have come out of 2020. It's forced people into a place where they have to use it. I know a lot of colleagues around the world. I've had constant debates and arguments with people down the years about the benefits of using technology. And people always say to me, I was in a debate several years ago with two academic colleagues in front of about 200 students in an audience. And the other two were very anti-technology, and they both challenged me and said, "Steve, just give us one example of how technology has made a difference in education." And I said, "That's easy, special educational needs." And they both shut up. They said, "Oh, well, you win that one." And the audience applauded because, you know, just that single phrase should give it away that actually technology does make a difference.
Yeah.
You know, where special educational needs is concerned, it enables learning in many instances rather than just supporting it. So it does make a difference. And now people are beginning to realize that it does make a difference. And it makes a very positive difference if you use it appropriately, if you use it effectively. So I think from that has arisen a lot of work. I know myself, I wrote 6 new modules, online modules, for the Zillearn platform way back in March and April when this all blew up. And they've had hundreds and hundreds of uses because people want to know, you know, how do I best leverage technology for online learning? How do I best assess people at a distance? How do I know it's the person that I'm assessing? You know, what about my digital identity? You know, what am I pushing across when I'm on social media? All these things are questions that educators are coming to grips with now, and they've had to. So that's one good thing, I think, that's emerged from 2020. There are other things as well, you know, certain presidential elections. And I've got a granddaughter on the way this week as well. So, I mean, there are some good things that have come out of it, but it's been a very, as you say, strange year and quite a tragic year in many ways.
So I just take it from what you've been saying that online learning, online education are almost, well, they're certainly in the mainstream now. You think that people are actually approaching the online world with a bit more courage, perhaps a bit more sense of inevitability?
I don't know about courage. I think they're doing it because they have to. And probably when this COVID crisis is over, they'll just slip back into their old, you know, I'm a bit of a pessimist when it comes to education because, you know, I've been around in it long enough to see that people do slip back into their old methods and defense mechanisms and so on. But I think that some people have truly had an epiphany. I speak to some colleagues and former colleagues and some teachers around the world because I'm on various social media networks and I have quite a lot of communities that I'm involved in. And they are telling me, yeah, I've had a change of mind and I see the possibilities now. And now I'm working on improving my methods, improving my pedagogy online and so on. So, there's room to be optimistic, but I think generally speaking, a lot of educators will just slip back into what they know best or what the way they were taught. And I think that's not, I'm not pushing any blame there because I think that a lot of teachers and educators are under a lot of pressure, time pressure and pressure to get students to succeed. And I think this whole idea around assessment using exams and testing is an absolute nightmare. It should never be allowed to continue. It's probably the most counterproductive thing in education that we've ever done, and I think it should stop. But it's ingrained, and that will continue, and that causes a lot of the pressure on school teachers in particular. So high stakes testing is just a nightmare. And if I may be a bit political here, you know, even things like PISA don't help. They cause governments to impose these strictures on education, and I think that should stop as well. But I'm pessimistic about that too. I'm afraid it's not going to happen. It's going to continue, and that will continue to heap pressure on teachers, and therefore they will have very little time and very little energy to be able to innovate.
Mm. So, Steve, I know that the whole concept of putting pedagogy before technology is more than just platitude for you. When it comes to assessment, I mean, you've just picked up on some of the assessment practices that tend to find themselves into the online space. What do you think would be pedagogically preferable? What sort of advice would you offer to those seeking to assess differently now that we've got access to online tools?
Do you know, I wrote a whole series of articles on alternative methods to assessment. They're all on the blog. So, that's my glib answer, my short answer. But people should go and have a look at it and then make their comments because there are lots of opinions on this. And people, you know, who are listening to this podcast now are probably shaking their heads and thinking, he doesn't know what he's talking about. But, you know, I've had that all my life. I've had that all my career. Oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Let's keep thinking about this. Let's keep struggling and fighting about this because it's worth it for future students. One of the methods that I've seen used quite well, especially in technology, is to get students to drive their own assessment processes. As long as it's in agreement with your things like word count and things like the assessment criteria, those are the main things. If students can keep to those, give them space to innovate. Give them space to be creative. I once I broke the mold at my own university about 10 years ago. I walked into one of my groups, one of my BA groups, actually it was, BA in Education Studies groups, and they were third year, and so they were quite experienced students. So that needs to be kind of factored in. And I said to them, okay, your assessment, it says here a 5,000-word assignment or equivalent. I said, so the equivalent is important here. I said, so you don't have to write an essay. What you do have to do is to convince me that you are meeting the assessment criteria with the mode that you choose. Some of them said, can I write a blog? I said, yep, as long as it's got an equivalency and as long as it meets the assessment criteria. And someone else said, can I do a video? I said, yeah, sure, why not? And we negotiated a word equivalency. And other people were doing things like podcast series and somebody else did an exhibition using digital artifacts. Mm-hmm. And at the end, they all submitted their assignments. And then at that point, my administration people went up the wall. They said, Steve, we need printouts of all this. I said, well, good luck printing a video. They went absolutely ape with me. And so I said, well, what's your problem? They said, well, nobody's done this before. I said, well, that doesn't mean we say we shouldn't do it. They said, well, the external examiner is going to go mad. I said, give me the phone. I picked up the phone and I spoke to my external examiner, and he loved the idea. And they ran out of complaints in the end, and they had to let me do it. You know, it was done anyway. I wasn't going to back down because I believed in it. And that for me was a form of what I would call it ipsative assessment. Ipsative assessment comes from special educational needs area, for those of you who are not familiar with it. An ipsative assessment basically is where students are assessed against their own previous attainment, their own previous grades. I hesitate to use the word grade because that's part of the problem, but their own levels of achievement. And what you can do with that is astounding, because you're not measuring students necessarily against a set level of criteria anymore. You're measuring them against what they believe to be important in their profession, in their career, in their progression, if you like, learning. And that's controversial, I know that, but it's not impossible to achieve. And you can actually use this in many, many different fields, giving students the choice and giving them the creative space to be able to innovate their own assessment.
Yeah. Steve, you'd be aware of the research out there at the moment on online education. What are some of the gaps and what's some of the research you'd most like to see done?
Well, as a psychologist, I'm biased in my answer here, but I think a lot more should be done in perception. You know, what do students perceive? What do they experience when they come into an environment where they're sat in rows or where they're sat in a circle? You know, when there's 179 other students or 330 other students in the room with them, what about the shy students? How do they cope? You know, how do we engage students more? How do we get students to involve themselves in online collaborative spaces more? There's a whole range of things around lurking. And around disengagement or lack of engagement. And what is engagement? You know, all of these questions around perception and involvement, the student experience, still needs a lot more work, a lot more study.
Yeah, student experience certainly resonated as soon as you started talking about the different questions that you'd ask and the different people you talk with. Yeah, so it really comes down to a student's understanding of their context, what it might mean for them, what perception they have of their own role, perhaps, in the educational cycle.
Yeah, it's not just role, it's identity as well. It's the whole thing. It's, you know, what is my identity in this large group? You know, I know myself when I was at school, you know, just a word from the teacher and it made me feel an inch high, and then I shut up for the rest of the day or whatever. You know, it is about personal perceptions and about your identity, your role. It's a whole range of it's a very complex set of factors and issues that need to be researched.
So Steve, coming back to your earlier experience about assessing students in a fairly open way, you must have been working very, very hard during that time. I understand many people see online education as the opportunity to make teaching and learning more scalable. How did that work out for you? How busy were you in those student assessments?
I eat, sleep, and drink learning. I still do. I mean, it's my career, but it's also my hobby. Someone once said to a colleague of mine, how is it that Steve writes so many articles and gets so many things published and gets to speak in so many countries? And, you know, and he replied to them, and it was an honest reply because he knew me quite well. He's my roomie at one point. He shared an office with me. He said, for most people, writing an academic article or speaking at a conference is work. For Steve, it's a hobby, and he was right. It's something I once said to my boss and nearly made her fall off her chair. I said, you know, most people here, you know, work for a living. I said, I get paid to do what I enjoy doing, you know. Yeah, well, I cut your salary. but I meant to, you know, I used to go to work every day or work from home every day with a lot of joy in my heart. I still do because for me, this is the ultimate thing, helping people to learn, you know, and opening up, exposing new ideas, getting people to see new things, that's the most exciting thing for me. and it always will be. So, I worked hard, but I didn't really work hard. I just enjoyed it. I think my family suffered. I spent a lot of time on the road and away, all three of my kids have grown up happy, healthy people. And my wife's still an educator. She still teaches. She does a lot of work online. And we've got a happy family. And so I don't think it's damaged anything, but it's certainly at the time, I was very driven. I think I still am in many ways.
Well, Steve, two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you and one who you think otherwise might have an important perspective to share.
I spent a lovely 36 hours with a couple of people in Wales a few years ago. One was Martin Weller, who you may know, who's been a keynote speaker at Eden on at least two occasions. He's an old friend of mine. And he's a professor of educational technology at the Open University in the UK. His work, as you know, it has been all around open learning and openness. And that's one of my passions as well. So his book, The Digital Scholar, I think was quite seminal. And I went and stayed at his house. And I brought with me a person who I mentioned earlier on, an American educator called Amy Burval, who you may not have heard of, but Amy was probably one of the most popular YouTube stars back in about 10 years ago when she produced a series of YouTube videos, music videos. So she took popular songs and she rewrote the words and she acted out loads of different historical events like, Marie Antoinette and Charlemagne and, I don't know, Henry VIII and his six wives, all these. And she actually recorded these as YouTube videos, and they've had millions of hits. That's one of her claims to fame. And she's an incredible educator, and she came across to the UK, and we both went across and stayed at Martin's house and had a meal with him. Mm-hmm. So those two, I think, I would recommend as very interesting people if you're in the world of ed tech.
Absolutely. Yeah, I did interview Martin way back, actually, towards the start of the podcast when I was still with the Open University. Yeah, fascinating work he's done. Well, Steve, it's been fantastic talking with you. You've obviously been a very driven, hardworking, but also incredibly productive individual with some fantastic ideas. Thank you so much for being a legend and leader of online learning.
Thank you very much.
You can learn more about Steve and his work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.